Each year, as we celebrate the coming in of the new year, we do it through meditation and prayer, communion with the Infinite Spirit. Every year, I think practically of my adult life, this is how I've done it. And it feels so purifying, so uplifting. Sometimes meditation is a struggle. Sometimes it's a battlefield. Other times, it's the plane of heavenly consciousness. Whatever the case is this evening, as we stretch our time in meditation, focusing our mind upon God alone, dedicating ourselves towards realizing that highest level of consciousness, let us be mindful of the purpose for which we came here. And know that God is dwelling within us and is looking for every opportunity to reveal itself to us. Lately, I've had the idea that God is the mother. And as the mother is a loving presence, Jesus said in his conception of God as the Father, that the Father loves you more than any earthly parent could possibly love you. That he takes care of us, that he looks after all of our needs. Even so, the Divine Mother so tenderly looks after her children. I once had an image in meditation. In that image was an old-fashioned house with the backyard, large porch, the grandmother and the grandfather in their rocking chairs, watching out over their grandchildren as they played in the backyard, all encircled in the safety of the shrubbery and the fencing of the backyard. So there is no worry that the children were outside of the sight or the care of the grandparents. As children play and are apt to, some would be having little accidents here and there, some would be in tussles with one another, fighting over this toy or that, and the grandparents didn't interfere too much. But here and there, there would be a small child who would be crying, and some of the other children would cry to come over and comfort them. But they would not be comforted. They cried for their grandparents, and of course, the heart of the grandparents were touched, and they went out and they got that one, taking it back to their rocking chair and rocking that one, holding it and folding it in their arms, in the love of their care. And so all the play went on. And I related it to this life, that we of ourselves, of our human selves, primarily see ourselves as self-sufficient. We go through life and we get bumps and bruises along the way. But always we are in the safety of the yard of the parents, the grandparents, our heavenly mother and father. And if at any point we sit and we cry for the infinite and will not be comforted with anything less, then that heavenly parent will come to us, will pick us up in its arms, enfold us in its presence, and bring us into their own being until we are part and parcel in total union with that consciousness. You see, we bemoan the fact that we live in separation from God. But there is a disingenuous aspect to that, in that if we were truly dedicated towards realizing the one consciousness, then we would have it. The fact that we do not have it means that we have not yet sufficiently honed our devotion, our desire for truth, to the point where we have it. But when we do so, I can assure you, then we have that presence. We have that union, that yoga. with the infinite. I would like to read this evening from The Holy Science by Swami Sri Yukteswar. This is on the chapter entitled The Goal. So long, however, as man identifies himself with his material body and fails to find repose in his true self, he feels his wants according to his heart's desires remain unsatisfied. To satisfy them, he has to appear often in flesh and blood on the stage of life, subject to the influence of darkness, Maya, and has to suffer all the troubles of life and death, not only in the present, but in the future as well. Ignorance, avidya, is misconception, or is the erroneous conception of the existence of that which does not exist. Through avidya, man believes that this material creation is the only thing which substantially exists, there being nothing beyond. Forgetting that this material creation is substantially nothing and is a mere play of ideas on the eternal spirit, the only real substance beyond the comprehension of the material creation. This ignorance is not only a trouble in itself, but is also the source of all other troubles of man. In order to understand how this ignorance is the source of all other troubles, we should remember that ignorance, avidya, is nothing but a particle of darkness, Maya, taken distributively. And as such, it possesses the two properties of Maya. The one is its darkening power by the influence of which man is prevented from grasping anything beyond the material creation. This darkening power produces asmita, or egotism, being the identification of the self with the material body, which is but the development of atom, the particles of the universal force. And avnibhisya, or blind tenacity to the belief in the validity and ultimate worth of material creation. By virtue of the second of the properties of Maya, ignorance or avidya in its polarized state produces an attraction for certain objects and repulsion for others. The objects so attracted are objects of pleasure for which an attachment, raga, is formed. The objects that are repulsed are the objects producing pain for which aversion, or dvesa, is formed. By the influence of these five troubles, ignorance, egotism, attachment, aversion, and tenacity to the material creation, man is induced to involve himself in egoistic works and in the consequence he suffers. With man, the cessation of all sufferings is artha, the heart's immediate aim. The complete extirpation of all these sufferings, their recurrence becoming impossible, is paramartha, the ultimate goal. Man naturally feels great necessity for sat, existence, chit, consciousness, and ananda, bliss. These three are the real necessities of the human heart and have nothing to do with anything outside his self. They are essential properties of his own nature, as explained before. When man becomes fortunate in securing the favor of any divine personage, Satguru, the Savior, and affectionately following his holy precepts, he is able to come to direct all his attention inward. He becomes capable of satisfying all wants of his heart and can thereby get contentment, ananda, the real bliss. With his heart thus contented, man becomes able to fix his attention upon anything he chooses and can comprehend all its aspects. So chit, consciousness, of all the modifications of nature, up to its first and primal manifestation, the word Amen, Om, and even of his own real self gradually appears. And being absorbed in the stream thereof, man becomes baptized and begins to repent towards his divinity, the eternal Father, where he had fallen. Man, being conscious of his own real position and the nature of this creation of darkness, becomes possessed of absolute power over it and gradually withdraws all the developments of ignorance. In this way, coming above the control of this creation of darkness, he comprehends his own self as indestructible and ever-existing real substance. So sat, the existence of self, comes to light. All the necessities of the heart, sat, existence, chit, consciousness, and ananda, bliss, have been attained. Ignorance, the mother of evils, becomes emaciated, and consequently all troubles of this material world, which are the source of all sufferings, cease forever. Thus, the ultimate aim of the heart is effected. In this state, all the necessities having been attained and the ultimate aim effected, the heart becomes perfectly purified. And instead of merely reflecting the spiritual light, actively manifests the same. And thus, being consecrated or anointed by the Holy Spirit, becomes Christ, the anointed Savior. And entering the kingdom of spiritual light, he becomes the Son of God. In this state, man comprehends his self as a fragment of the universal Holy Spirit, and abandoning the vain idea of a separate existence, unifies himself with the eternal Spirit, i.e., becomes one and the same with God the Father. This unification of self with God is Kaivalya, which is the ultimate object of all created beings. And a quote from John, chapter 19, verse 2. Believe me that I am in the Father, and the Father in me. And I would like to read also from The Journey to Self-Realization by Paramahansa Yogananda, taken from one of his talks, given in Hollywood Temple, January 3rd, 1943. Today's subject is a very important one. Everything you hear this morning, you should strive to remember and to put into practice. It is so easy to be inspired momentarily and then forget much of what you heard. This is why I often employ repetition, for to penetrate the hard core of human consciousness, a truth must be repeated again and again. By such review, it gradually becomes a habitual part of one's thoughts. There is a vast difference between just listening to a lecture and applying the truths it contains. Everything my guru told me, I put into practice. As a result of his training, I have always kept my spiritual priorities straight. I never miss three things: my meditations, morning and night, my energization exercises, and service to others. These I religiously perform. All else of less importance I somehow manage. Living in the consciousness of God, I find many things that once seemed necessary have become unnecessary. Last night, I felt no need for sleep because of my awareness of God was so strong. Once in a while, I would see my body asleep, but that subconscious sleep, samadhi, soon slipped away, and my mind and body were filled solely with the consciousness of God. These things I tell you come from my own direct experience, and one day they will be a part of your realization. Through him whom I perceive within, it is possible to transmit to those who are in tune the light of God that is in me. It is not I, but he who is in me, whom I extol. Just as the wealthy man can bestow his fortune on his worthy children, So it is possible for a man of spiritual wealth to bequeath his divine riches to those disciples who follow his example. This is true of all great masters. There are many instances of this transmission of spiritual consciousness, such as the mantle of Elijah that fell on Elisha, and the Holy Ghost imparted by Christ to faithful 11 of his 12 chosen close disciples. Many come to the spiritual path, but it is those who remain steadfast to the end who will enter the kingdom of heaven. True devotees, those who see that the murky paths of this world all lead to disillusionment, steadily pursue God, never doubting him. It doesn't matter whether he answers or not. The devotee inwardly prays, "Lord, thou knowest I am coming, so I care not when thou wilt reply to me. Though I am undeserving of thy response, yet thou canst not refuse me when the time is right." As soon as God is convinced that you are in earnest and nothing can turn you away from him, then even through the Guru, he gives you the final realization. The Guru transmits to you the light of God that flows through them. Perhaps you thought you would never know such a blessing. That supreme experience I received from my Guru. He gave me by his touch what I could not attain by the power and effort of my meditations alone. Beginning this new year, make firm spiritual resolutions. I have made a few myself, and pray with all my heart that with the blessings of the Father and Gurudev, I will carry these through. We are made of a matrix of consciousness. All life was spumed out of one source of the river of consciousness. Your individualized consciousness is thus the very foundation of your existence. All of your thoughts and actions are bubbles and droplets of the river of consciousness. The seemingly solid body is actually a mass of electromagnetic currents. Its electrons and protons are condensations of relative positive and negative current thoughts projected by God, what I call thoughttrons. All creation derives from these thoughttrons, the consciousness of God. What is the difference between black and white? There are two contrasting thoughts, each frozen into its particular concept. That is all. For example, black horses and white horses in a dream are nothing but different crystallizations, relatives of the dreamer's one stream of thought. In the ultimate sense, then, all things are made of pure consciousness. Their finite appearance is the result of relativity of consciousness. Therefore, if you want to change anything in yourself, you must change the process of thought that occasions the materialization of consciousness into different forms of matter and action. That is the way, the only way, to remold your life. I can give a directive to my mind and at once it will react or behave accordingly. Most people who make up their minds to stop smoking or to stop eating so many sweets will continue with those actions in spite of themselves. They do not change because their minds, like blotting paper, have soaked up habits of thought. Habit means that the mind believes it cannot get rid of a particular thought. Habit indeed is tenacious. Once you perform an action, it leaves an effect or an impression on the consciousness. As a result of this influence, you are likely to repeat that action. After several repetitions, the inclination is so strengthened that the action becomes a habit. In some people, just one act is enough to form a habit because of a latent predisposition from their past lives. The mind may tell you that you cannot free yourself from a particular habit. But habits are nothing but repetitions of your own thoughts, and these have the capacity to change. The nature of habit can be understood by this analogy. Clay can be molded into a vase, and while the clay is still soft, it is easy to change the form of that vase again and again. But once it is fired in an oven, its shape becomes firmly set. So it is with your consciousness. Your thoughts are molding your actions, And your mental convictions from the repetition of these actions is the fire that hardens the thoughts into unyielding habit pattern. Why are the faces of all of you different? Because your minds are different. Your habit patterns of thoughts have molded not only your mind, but also your body. You have probably noticed that some thin people might eat 5 meals a day and yet never gain weight. And some heavy people may eat very little and yet become heavier. Why? The former, sometime in a past life, established the thought of in their consciousness that they were thin. And in this life, they brought that thought and tendency with them. No matter what they do, they never grow fat. It is the same with obese persons. In past lives, they left this world with the consciousness of being fat. And they brought the seed of that thought into their present existence. The whole physiology of the body responds to these karmic seed tendencies. If you want to change your constitution, then you have to say, it is I who thought myself into being thin, or heavy, or sickly. Now I will myself to be robust, or whatever you so desire. If you get rid of the thought that has made you other than what you want to be, you will see the body change. I can maintain my weight, or as easily be thin at will. My trouble as a youth was that I was too thin. Master cured me of that consciousness, so ever since I have preferred to be heavier. Most people are psychological antiques. They never change. Year after year, always the same. Everyone has self-limiting idiosyncrasies. But they were not put into your nature by God, but were created by you. These are what you must change by remembering that these habits, peculiar to your nature, are nothing but manifestations of your own thoughts. If you feel that your character is not what you think it should be, remember that it was molded by none other than yourself. Certainly there are outside influences, but inner acceptance is the determining factor. If everyone says that Johnny is a bad boy and Johnny accepts that condemnation, he may not make the effort to be good. He adopts the negative thought. But if he had refused to accept it, he could have been different. One must never give up hope of becoming better. A person is old only when he refuses to make the effort to change. That stagnant state is the only old age I recognize. When a person says again and again, I can't change, this is the way I am, then I have to say, all right, stay that way, since you have made up your mind to be like that. Try to be more pliable, like children. However, even some children are old before their time because they have lacked the training and have not been given the incentive to change past life tendencies. Their mental clay is already fixed in the oven, and they grow up with the same inclinations they had in childhood. On the other hand, there are aged people with whom I have talked just once, and they have changed for the better. God is not a respecter of age, for the soul is ageless. Those who are always ready to improve and expand themselves are like receptive children. Those who grow in understanding become more childlike. The great masters are like that. To be childlike doesn't mean one is wishy-washy. I am not afraid of anything in this world. No one can intimidate me. I live for God and truth, and I love everyone. If someone misunderstands me, I try to establish understanding. But if I cannot change the person, neither can I be moved by his bad behavior. If a non-understanding person has made up his mind against you, why should you change in order to please or placate him? Stand by your principles when you are right and be willing instantly to change yourself when you are wrong. Wonderful words of wisdom. I'm struck by what a tremendous soul Master was. And indeed, it seems in his life that he had that childlike nature. that he was soft on the inside, but also he had that terrific will on the outside. Once he was speaking of having taken up the habit of drinking coffee when he came to America. It was when he was out with other people and they would be socializing together, and so others would order coffee and he would do the same. One day he was at a restaurant. No one else was there with him. He ordered coffee and he realized that he was craving it. He gave up coffee and didn't go back to it. This is the way that he was. He recognized the power of repeated habit patterns, that they are like the needle that carves a groove in a record, and that the more often you repeat that habit pattern, the more ingrained it becomes in the hardware of your mind. There's actual thought patterns that get connected within your own brain. The more you use them, the more they form connections, and those solid connections. So the more you repeat a certain thought, a certain pattern of behavior, the more it becomes ingrained in the very wiring of your own brain. Not only that, but we create a greater attachment for it. Even if it's a pattern that produces a negative effect, we can still be attached to it because it's familiar. It's who we come to think of ourselves as. So to realize that habit patterns can serve us, but they are our servants. They are not our masters. When we come to recognize that any habit pattern has become master over us and does not serve us any longer, then it is to our benefit to learn to break it. Now we can start this with smaller habits. Things that we recognize in our life that we just want to change. Perhaps we are always in a hurry, not mindful of what we're doing. We're always pressured. And we want to change that habit. So we begin by watching our breath, by relaxing, by not pushing. You know, the marvelous thing is about that, is that things go along about the same or maybe even a little bit better because we don't make mistakes as often that way. We're more mindful. We're more conscious of what we're doing. There's a practice in Zen meditation of a moving meditation. It is simply being aware of your body totally and completely as you move. Whatever you're doing, you're fully mindful of what you're doing. Try it sometime. It's wonderful. It brings your mind right into the present. It puts you in touch with all the movements and all the things that you are directly doing in that moment in the world. There is a book by Eugene Herigold entitled Zen and the Art of Archery. And the beginning of the book has quite a demonstration where the Zen master went out to the archery field. It was nighttime. They turned the lights off. He heard one arrow fly, then another. The lights were turned on. They went the distance to the targets, and there was the first arrow, right dead center in the bullseye. The second arrow split the first arrow right down the center. This is self-mastery around this particular art of archery to its highest degree. Eugene Herigold, of course, was quite impressed by this. And so he took up the practice, and even learning to string the bow took him a long time to do it at all and then to do it properly. Learning to pull the bow string back because it was quite difficult. And then to learn the steadiness of body and mind. And gradually, with discipline, he was able to accomplish this. After reading this book, I decided to experiment with it. So I tried doing Zen and the art of, you name it, whether it was driving down the street or the highway, whether it was cleaning the toilet bowl. If it was walking down the street, it was bringing full mindfulness of myself into that moment, and it was wonderful and produced terrific results. Just to do that brings our heart rate down, our anxiety down. So much of our mind is preoccupied with what we're going to be doing, what we should be doing, what we should have done, what we should not have done, and takes away from the moment. So I think a fine resolution is to make to be more mindful, more present, each and every moment, until that becomes a habit inside of us. If we are doing a certain activity, and suddenly we come to, and we realize that we've been preoccupied with all the things that we need to do that day, perhaps being behind in our schedule, we notice our body and we see that it is tense. Our energy is erratic and scattered in every direction. Our thoughts are racing from here to there inefficiently. Then we know that we've fallen off that path and we can draw ourselves back. Now this doesn't happen all at once. It is a practice. It is a discipline. It is the act of bringing your mind back. But I can tell you that the benefits are absolutely wonderful. It also makes us extremely mindful of habit patterns. When we eat, for instance, out of habit rather than need. When we do nervous actions out of habit instead of what is needed in that moment. Do you know people who can never sit still? Who can never take time to meditate? Because their minds are racing, there's such a disturbance. They are so far from peace, so far from being centered in themselves. And yet the most difficult thing in the entire world would be for them to sit and just to be with themselves. Not only that, but there is a great fear about it. You know, fear is one of the four dragons that I think of as standing at the gate towards our own inner kingdom of heaven, the gate of our own peace. Fear of being overwhelmed, fear of being out of control, fear that if we let go and let God, that we will somehow lose. We will be something less than what we wanted to be. We will have less than what we wanted to be. We are so firmly convinced that we hold this whole universe together. It is us. And if we let go, everything will fall apart. This is folly. When we are able to let go, we continue to do these things in the world that we need to do to get along. But the world doesn't fall apart. In fact, if anything, things tend to go a little easier. People find us to be a little easier to be around, and therefore respond differently to us. People begin to see the light within you, and they respond to it. And you feel it within you. You no longer are just reflecting that light. But as Sri Yukteswar talked tonight, you are actively manifesting it. When you enter into this realm, you are truly living. You have entered into the soul's realm. You have entered into your own heavenly consciousness. And it is not something far away. It is not something that is relegated for just a few others and not you. This is your inheritance. This is what you came to do. This is your life. Living your life unconsciously or refusing to look at the higher calling in your life is to be as if you are dead. But when you tune in to this wonderful spiritual consciousness that is present within you, even this moment, whether you are aware of it or not, this is to truly live and to have life even more abundantly. So whatever we seemingly give up in terms of personal will, of personal preferences, and we surrender and we let go of, we get double in return. This is one of the meanings of Jesus talking about the man who had 10 talents and went out and invested them all. He got all of his share in return and doubled. But the man who took his talent and went out and buried it in the ground, he had even that which was given to him taken away and given to the man with 10 talents. You have been given gifts in this life. You have been given a vision in this life, whether you realize it or not, something to fulfill in this life. And unless you take this life that has been given to you and take it out and make something of it, manifest the spiritual light within yourself in this world, then even that which you have been given shall be taken away from you. But if you take that and you fulfill the purpose for which you came, then you will be given double what it was that you had in the first place. So don't be deceived by that fear. That's like the little devil, you know, that's sitting on your shoulder, constantly whispering to you, don't do it. Don't let go. Don't focus your attention on God. Everything else takes more importance, takes more precedence. I don't have time to meditate. I'm so tired tonight. And yet, if you did not have God in your life, if God did not give you the power to live and breathe and have your being, you could not do any of the other things. As Master said, he kept those three things sacrosanct. Meditating night and day, the energization exercises. Those are the things that gave him substance in the world and service to others. When we serve others, we serve ourselves. For in truth, there is no difference between ourselves and others. When you serve, don't make it a thing of I'm doing this great thing for another person. Rather, see it as a natural expression of yourself. Even as the flower gives of its fragrance to the world, so it is natural for you to give of yourself to this world. It is not a thing to stand on. It is not a thing to induce pride in you or any of the other things. You can feel the goodness of it flow through you. And certainly there is pleasure in that. But it is not in the results that you get, but simply being yourself. So these things I say to you, not necessarily because you don't know these things, but as Master talked about, the repetition puts it more clearly and firmly into the mind, and mind too. As I say these words, I listen to them. I feel them deep in my soul. They come from a source deeper than myself. I don't think about what I'm going to talk about before I talk about it. It comes spontaneously from a deeper source inside. So I listen also. And the things that I say, I am most in need of hearing. But this is wonderful. And it carves a new groove in the brain. It begins to unseat the old habit patterns, the old thought patterns. And it creates those new patterns in the brain, and it reinforces it. And these words come not just from my source, therefore they have a power to them. And they have the power to uplift a receptive mind. Now, I don't say this out of any sense of doership. This would be true for all of us. At any time, any of us speak from that highest consciousness, and those words come spontaneously from us, we can be sure that a good is being wrought. That a good is being wrought. And that we need be nothing but an observer, a witness to what's being done within us. These great masters, Mother and Master, Sri Yukteswar, Larhi Mahasya, Babaji, They have all come to be an example and also a blessing. The pattern that they carved in the world is one of full, unqualified God realization. Therefore, they are the pattern. They are the paradigm that we need to tune ourselves into and that helps lift us up into a higher and new state of consciousness. God consciousness is infinitely vast. It is much more than any one of us can encompass in a human sense. But it is tremendous, and it is exciting, and it is filled with joy and with learning. I think one of the great changes that came over me in my life actually was something that I confronted when I was in my master's program as a counselor. We had an exercise in that program, and it was really quite a good one, very instructive. The exercise was very simple. We drew a door on a piece of paper. And that was the doorway to our home from our childhood. Over that door, we were to write whatever rule or law some stranger would need to know in order to get along in our family. It's kind of an interesting thing if you want to try it sometime. Well, the first thing that came to me, because we had a very definite rule that you didn't make controversial statements or you weren't outrageous in your ideas, that to express no strong opinions about anything. You know, the kind of go along to get along kind of attitude. And that was held up highly. And then I thought about it a little bit more and I thought, you know, that's not quite it. What really seems to fit is, don't express yourself. Don't be yourself. There's a high value in covering that up, especially if it took on anything that was the least bit negative or difficult. And so I made this thought to reveal myself as the thing that I most wanted in my life. Now, I had started that long before that, but it crystallized it in my mind in a way that gave me a positive focus. That who I was, I did not need to be ashamed of. I had that to such a degree that even if I just held a different view from somebody else, that was something to be ashamed of. That was something not to say because it might upset somebody. Might be different from what somebody else wanted or what somebody else thought. And it was essentially the message of being a non-entity, a non-being. And so it was soul-killing. And the only place I could find room that I allowed myself to have room was in my own thoughts, to be myself. But I didn't bring that out into the world. I had an interesting reading one time that was an astrological reading. And in that reading, it said that one of the things I came in with was a lot of spiritual and metaphysical knowledge, but that what I needed to do in this world in order to complete my task was to bring that out into the open, to teach it. Well, through my spiritual path and through Mother's grace, I've had that opportunity. And I can assure you, it's not a natural one. I'm one who would much rather sit in the background and let somebody else take the lead. But here I am. And I'm loving it. It's fun. Because I keep it connected to myself. I never know what the impact is of what I say or what I do. But I know whether it fits inside of me. I know whether it's in attunement with the highest spiritual consciousness of which I am capable of attaining at this point. And if it matches that criteria, then I am satisfied with it. If I feel that upliftment, if I feel that power of spirit, if I feel that pure wisdom and that intelligence come through, then I am satisfied. and I take it as an article of faith that it will be for the highest good of everyone concerned. And so it's not a matter of pleasing others, but it is pleasing that internal sense of what I know of as truth. This is a completely different way of living than my old way of living, which was not to reveal myself, not to show anything of myself, that everything was an article of shame, even good things. And so it's a wonderful release and change in my life. And it's one that I wholeheartedly recommend for anybody who may be struggling with something similar. Let your light so shine. Let your light shine. Let the light of God within you shine. Let it come through your being. Let it come through your skin. Let it come through your actions. Let your words reflect it. Let your thoughts be imbued with it. Let you become so absorbed in that, that that becomes who and what. The old part of your mind that calculated what you would say, what would you do, planning every aspect of your life, begins to gradually disappear as his full reliance comes on the spontaneity of spirit within you. As you recognize the power of that consciousness coming through you and how it changes you, and then also how you notice it changes others in your life. It's a great thing. And it's something that I would highly recommend. So let us let go of the old way of doing things. That from the ego center. We can use our intelligence. There's nothing wrong with that. But let us more so tune in to that intuitive intelligence. Let us tune in to that purity of thought, that purity of energy, that purity of consciousness right within us, that sat, that pure existence. You know, so much of what keeps us ill at ease in this world is our fear of death. That consciousness of sat is pure existence. And when we touch in with that, we realize we are not this body. We are not these transitory feelings or these transitory thoughts, but we are that eternal spirit. And in connecting with that and strengthening our connection with that, we lose our fear of death because we no longer identify just with this body consciousness. But we are eternally connected to spiritual consciousness, and that cannot die. It cannot die. What is real can never become unreal, and what is real, unreal, has never had any true existence. So it's a matter of letting go of these attachments to this body, recognizing that it is a vain influence on us. So at this time of year, I think it's useful to reflect on this past year. And we can think of the things that we feel good about. And we can also think of those things that we regret. Not with an eye of feeling shameful about it, but rather with an eye of learning from it. And that has been one of the great transformations, is shifting from that shame base to that of being a learner, to learn from my experience. Shame wants to hide itself. A learner wants to bring things out into the open, to expose things. Shame wants to become unconscious of things, push them away out of the conscious perception. A learner wants to bring them into sharp relief, to analyze them, to think about them, to embrace them even, to draw out of it all of the learning that can happen from that. Shame wants to hide itself away in darkness. A learner wants to step into the light to see all the better. They are direct and polar opposites, one from the other. And we can easily assess in any particular situation what we're dealing with. If we're being shame-based in the way we approach our life, or if we're being a learner and learning from our experience. Learning means growth. Shame means death. Death of the soul, to be the walking, but the walking dead. So these are some thoughts and reflections that I have as I think about this coming year and saying goodbye to this past year and knowing that this new year brings with it untold potential. It is up to me as to whether I want to fully step into it or not. I had an interesting conversation with a carpenter earlier today. And he was making the point that he thought that there was an inevitability about events and that there was, in essence, no free will. And he wanted to know what I thought about that. I asked him, what helps you the most? Thinking about life with no free will? Or thinking about life as if you have the power to change things. Whether you can decide in the morning whether to get up and go to work or to roll back over and go back to sleep. He said, well, it really works better to think that I have free will. I said, well, there you have your answer. That there is, even in a play, when you know what the ending is going to be, if it is well acted, and if the story has something to commend itself to you, you can enjoy it thoroughly. I saw a movie recently called The Titanic. I know what happens at the end. We all know what happens at the end. But it's a wonderful movie. Beautifully acted and beautifully written. And even though you know what the ending is going to be, you can still enjoy every step of the way. So it is with this life. It's more useful to think of ourselves as having that free will. And I think that we do. But more than that, it's the way that draws out the best in me. And I think in all of us. So I think to think of ourselves as being helpless victims against inevitable odds is not helpful. We need to use every bit of our strength, every bit of our heart, every bit of our mind to do all that we can to invoke the grace of God in order to come into our lives, to lift us beyond all duality and deliver us at His feet so that we might know that we are His, and He is ours. And that mother and son, father and daughter are all one. All one. This is the greatest thing, to realize that in your own life. And then all fear of death, all thoughts of shame, all limitations drop away. As you realize that you are a child of the infinite, and that becoming one with that, you realize you have always been that, only ignorant of it. But now you are consciously in union with it, and therefore you have moved from being only the Son of Man to fulfilling your divine potential of being a son of God. Larry found this article written by Mother entitled God Comes to Visit that was published in The Vision. And while I've seen portions of this before, there's aspects that I'd not heard of, so I thought I'd read that this evening. It centers around her meeting with Papa Ramdas. After 10 years, God has once more directed my footsteps to his abode of bliss, that is Anandashram. As I sit here, bathed in the peace and joy of this holy atmosphere, and surrounded by those who give the most perfect love and service I have seen expressed anywhere, my mind wanders back over the years in review of the tremendous drama which has unfolded on the stage of my life since I first met Swami Ramdas, our beloved Papa. What a saint he was and still is, because the divine which dwells within every man never dies. Particularly is this true of one such as Papa. His universal spirit still reaches out to the farthest corners of the earth to touch the hearts of men and entice them with his song of peace and joy and bliss to seek the Lord. It was in September of 1954 that I first heard of Papa. Reverend Bob Raymer of St. Paul, Minnesota, wrote and told me that a Swami friend of his was coming to America and would visit him and then fly to Seattle, Washington, which is my home. He asked if I would make it a point to see him and extend him any courtesy possible. I answered immediately, telling him that my husband and I would be most happy to have him as our guest. However, I received a reply stating that there were too many in the Swami's party for us to accommodate. Later, after Papa had arrived and we came to know how many were in the party, we knew we could have easily managed, but by then they were already established in the spacious quarters at the Hotel Edmund Meany, located in the University District where we lived. We have many times thought with regret of the great privilege it would have been to have had all of them in our home, and the wonderful time in God we would have had together. But there can be no doubt that the master architect of the universe had already done his own plan. Papa was expected in October. I received a call from Mrs. Max Greger, one of Papa's devotees who had charge of the arrangements for him in Seattle, telling me when he was expected and asking me if I would arrange for him to speak to the spiritual group which my husband and I headed here. I, of course, readily agreed and set about sending notices to the devotees. The day dawned when Papa was to arrive. Mrs. Greger telephoned and asked if I would go to the hotel and welcome him. I agreed. I donned a sari-like white robe, which I wore when giving lectures, stopped at the florist's shop and bought a dozen beautiful long-stemmed roses to present to him, and walked over to the hotel. As I stepped into the elevator to ascend to where the floor where Papa was staying, I was filled with mixed emotions. Anticipation at the prospect of meeting him, and hope that I would not be disloyal to my own guru in doing so. I had been a disciple of the great master Paramahansa Yogananda for 29 years, and my love and devotion for God in him was so great that even the thought of meeting another master seems somewhat sacrilegious. Let me hasten to add that this was not fostered as a result of anything my guru had said, but stemmed from my own feeling. During his lifetime, he entered Mahasamadhi on March 7, 1952. He taught all who followed him, and taught us well, that God was equally present everywhere, in every church, in every temple, in every religion, in every man, regardless of race, color, or creed, and in every atom of space. He told us that we must always pay homage to him equally in every saint whom we had the privilege to meet. However, to continue my story, as I left the elevator and walked down the hall to where Papa's suite of rooms was located, I saw two men standing outside his door. When I asked them if this was Swami Ramdas' suite, they said that it was, and I should just go in. As I started through the door, I saw Papa. He was alone and standing back in the room, but in front of the door. He took one look at me. His childlike face broke into a broad grin, and he started dancing as though he couldn't contain the joy of our meeting and must somehow express it. I didn't know what to think. I had never seen anyone behave like this in such a manner, but then I had never met anyone like Papa. It was the strangest thing that had ever happened to me. I introduced myself and presented him with the roses. He greeted me sweetly and then promptly threw the roses on a table beside him without any comment. This too seemed strange to me because my own guru had always been very careful to acknowledge any gift that was given to him. It wasn't until 3 years later I visited Anandashram that I understood the reason for Papa's behavior. He was garlanded from morning until night with beautiful flowers made by loving hands of many devotees who wished to express their love for him. Had he not immediately taken one off to make room for another, he would have fallen with the weight of the mountain of flowers. He also told me once that sometimes the flowers housed ants, and if he didn't take the garlands off quickly, they were apt to crawl all over him and bite him. Who can blame them for wanting to savor the sweet nectar of God, which permeated every part of his being? He invited me to be seated, and we sat and talked for a while, exchanging our views on God and his truth. I then asked him if we might meditate together, not realizing that for one who had already attained, there is no need to meditate. He and his father were already one. However, he said sweetly, "Yes, let us meditate." So I sat at his feet and immediately felt myself lifted into the presence of God. What peace! What joy, what bliss I experienced. He said afterwards that I had left body consciousness. I do not know. It was an indescribable experience. Little did I dream then that my meeting with him was to change the whole course of my life in order that I might fulfill my destiny. The momentous occasion of my first meeting with Papa ended with my offer to be of any service to him that I could. I also extended him an invitation to speak at our group the next evening, which he very graciously accepted. He arrived at our home promptly, accompanied by other members of his party, Mother Krishnabai, Swami Satchidananda, Rani Lalita Devi, and Sagarlar Gupta, none of whom had been present when I met him the previous day. As I opened the door, he stood there, his face aglow, beaming like a little child who had come to attend a birthday party. My heart was filled with divine love for him as I introduced him to the devotees who had been eagerly anticipating his coming. I told them it was a rare privilege to meet someone who was completely God-realized, because few there were indeed who have the courage, the determination, the love and devotion necessary to offer themselves and all they have in complete surrender at the lotus feet of the Lord, that he may be revealed to them in all of his wonder and glory. Papa smiled sweetly and asked what we would like to have him discuss. I told him we were eager to hear anything of his own choosing. So, knowing the depth of my love for my own guru, he spoke to us as follows on the greatness of saints. Beloved friends, you all know what it is to be in touch with a spiritual master. Many of you must have met such a master, basked in the sunshine of his grace, received his influence, and got your heart illumined with the light and presence of God. It is not only the inner longing for the supreme beloved of your heart that you should have, but also the contact of a God-realized soul, spiritually illumined and spiritually perfected. It is said by a great saint of India that the contact of saints is the most essential thing for one who is longing for God. In fact, God leads such a struggling soul to a saint because direct contact with the universal spirit is not possible. You cannot have a relationship with God as you can with the personification of his spirit. Such a personification is the spiritual master. Saints are the very embodiments or expressions of God. If you believe in them and look upon them as such, you can derive from their contact unlimited strength for your spiritual advancement. The mind is a very difficult thing to control. Although you keenly wish that the mind should always contemplate on God and think of Him constantly, it does not do so. You then require the help of a saint. This invaluable help a saint alone can give you. If you look upon Him as your sole spiritual guide, His light and grace will fall on you, and your heart will be freed from all impurities. It is said that a saint makes you like himself. Saints are often compared to the philosopher's stone, which, by its mere contact, turns any base metal into gold. But a saint is superior, for by his contact he makes you like himself. He fills you with divine radiance and joy. He awakens you to the awareness of the Spirit within you, and your mind thereafter will always be in divine peace. All your desires of the senses will leave you completely, and you are filled with the childlike innocence, purity, and love. You become the veritable expression of the divine. This is the goal to which the spiritual master's guidance leads you. Ram Dass can tell you from his own experience that he has become what he is by the blessings and grace of saints. Had saints not come to his help, he would have been still striving and searching to find God. But since saints' grace came to him, his doubts ceased and he began to feel the presence of God within. God took him to himself, absorbing him into his transcendent, all-pervading, and eternal being. We must keep the door of our heart open to receive the influence when we approach saints. Then alone, we can receive abundantly from them. Very few know the greatness of saints and spiritual masters. Even when they come to us and teach us and give us the benefit of their company, we do not understand them. This is true everywhere, not merely in Western countries, but also in Eastern countries. Very few understand saints or take advantage of their help and grace. Their hearts are always flowing out with love, compassion, and mercy towards those who come to them, and those who are open to receive the grace are saved. It is said that saints transmit their power in three ways: by thought, sight, and touch. If a saint thinks of a person, even though he is far away, that person is illumined. If he looks at a person, his entire being is shaken to its very foundation. A new consciousness dawns in him, and he finds himself a different person from that moment. If the saint touches a person, he feels a tremendous change taking place in him. In that thought, look as well as touch, there is so much love and compassion for the uplift, advancement, and illumination of the aspirant. The mind that seeks peace gets it in the presence of a saint by his grace. It is a peace that passeth all understanding. Man thinks that by his effort he will be able to attain God. This is entirely foolish. When we have struggled long, we come to know we cannot realize Him by our own effort. Then, in all humility, we surrender to the Master, and His grace flows into us. A humble heart alone can receive grace, not a proud one. Meekness is a necessary condition. Thus, the spiritual master brings about the inner awakening of the aspirant, who goes to him seeking peace, freedom, and joy. Based on this inner awakening of divine, true love dawns in his heart. Then he will love all beings and creatures because he sees God everywhere. The whole world now stands transformed at the very image of his beloved. He sees and loves his beloved in everybody. All this happens through the grace of the Master. Anybody, whether good or bad, who comes to him can get his grace. He is like a lamp that gives light to anybody who is near it. The lamp does not make any distinction as to whether those who go near it are good or bad. It gives light to everyone equally. So does the spiritual master. That is why it is said that the Master has equal vision. When people of different temperaments and nature approach him, all of them are blessed with his light and grace. If the master discriminates between the good and bad, where is there hope for the fallen soul? The purpose for which the spiritual master comes to the world is to save the fallen, to raise those who are living in a lower level, miserable and unhappy. The touch of a saint gives them a new birth, a new consciousness dawns on them. They feel happy, courageous, and strong because they feel the master, the presence of the master with them. The spiritual master never dies. He is not an ordinary person who dies and disappears from our life. When you once depend upon him, he is always there at your back to help you and guide you. If he takes you up once, you can always depend on him, for you are always under his shelter. He will not leave you until he raises you to his status completely. As soon as Ram Dass met a saint, he felt that very moment the master took his seat in his heart. His little self disappeared completely as he was possessed by the master. He was free from temptations as his mind was made pure and desireless. By the master's grace, he could see the beloved on the face of everybody. He was feeling every moment the presence of the divine. When Papa had finished his speech, I asked if he would touch the heads of everyone there and transmit his grace to them in that way. He said, yes, Ram Dass has committed himself. Hearing Papa agreed, Rani Lalita Devi was first in line and almost ran from the back of the room to receive his blessing. Papa laughed and joked about her as he blessed her. Someone in the party said later that it was very unusual for Papa to give individual blessings to everyone in a group. No doubt she wanted to be sure she availed herself of the privilege. I was the last in line, and as I knelt before him, I said to him, Papa, please ask the Divine Mother to manifest within me fully, that I might be filled with light and the bliss of his presence. He looked at me, smiled, placed both of his hands on the top of my head, and said, yes, it shall be so. Realizing the tremendous power of God in him, one can only imagine how I felt in receiving such a benediction. When I arose, Papa said to me, referring to the devotees present, you have here all of your fragrant flowers together. Are you all happy now? You must, of course, feel happy. With my heart overflowing with gratitude, I replied, when God himself has come to us, why should we not feel happy? Papa smiled a heavenly smile and said, God has come to see God. Hearing these words, the whole world seemed to stand still because they were the fulfillment of God's promise given to me several months before when I had offered myself to him in full surrender. The gracious Lord had lifted me into the state of Nirvikalpa Samadhi where, fully conscious, I lived in two worlds for 8 days. Moving in this state with very little sleep and almost no food, he revealed to me such wondrous things that the memory of them is forever engraved upon my soul. Then he spoke these unforgettable words, I shall meet you face to face, that our joy may be full. How could I doubt the reality of the vision? He had indeed come in Papa's form, and in my joy knew no bounds. As I stood before Papa, the bliss which permeated his being engulfed me like a flood. It was as though I was lifted up into the arms of God, and I felt like a little child. With tears flowing from my eyes, I asked, will you be my Papa too? He smiled his ever blissful smile and answered, yes, he is Papa to all. All are his children. The next few days after Papa's visit to our home were thrilling indeed. We are privileged to attend three of the meetings which he held, two at the chapel of the Church of the People, and one at the University Unitarian Church. In all of his discourses, he stressed universal love and service. He put forth a sublime vision of a world wherein all people loved one another, lived in perfect harmony, and made a veritable heaven of this earth. He had the certain knowledge not only that it could be done, but that it would come to pass. He said that this faith was grounded on the truth that the world was controlled by God, who is so good and merciful that he will bring about this most desirable consummation. What a messenger of God Papa was! How universal in his every approach of life! Those who were good and those who were evil, friends and enemies, the rich and the poor, the great and the humble, were all treated alike. To him, all were the forms of his infinite beloved. He poured forth the love of God from his being in such great measure that all who came before him finally melted and became helpless in that love. This is the true measure of a God-realized soul. No one can claim to be spiritual and have hate and animosity in his heart for any human being. Papa's greatness lay in his simplicity, his sweetness, and his childlike qualities. For him, there is no pomp nor ceremony, no worship of gods nor statues, no adherence to ritual or form. He believed only in the one Father God. Name, fame, and fortune meant nothing to him, because to him only the name of his beloved Ram was sweet. It was his glory alone which was to spread throughout the earth, and he considered himself to be the wealthiest of men, because he forever enjoyed the bliss of God's presence and had won the eternal gold of the Spirit. The only decoration he wore was the great light which shone on his face. He dressed in a simple white shirt and dhoti and took the name Ram Dass. He was indeed the humble servant of Ram. As I write these things from my heart, I am moved to tears, because his beloved form is no longer with us. But I have the certain knowledge that his blissful spirit hovers above the earth like a shining star in the heavens, lighting the way to paradise for men everywhere. The day for Papa's departure arrived too soon. He asked if we were coming to the airport to see them off, and I said, "Yes, of course, Papa. I don't want to miss a minute with you." My husband had to work, so my son-in-law, Ron Smith, drove with me to the airport. Mr. Sagarla Gupta rode with us, and we carried as much of the baggage as possible in our car. Papa and the rest of his party accompanied Mr. Gregor in his car. When he went into the airport, somehow I found myself sitting alone with Papa on a bench. I shall always remember those moments. He sat there looking for all the world like a little child. I reached over and took his hand and was thrilled when he made no move to take it away. He just beamed at me and started swinging one leg back and forth under the seat. A few minutes later, when I spent many months at the Anandashram, I often saw him swinging his leg back and forth in the manner, or gleefully slapping his knees as his feet danced up and down when either he or someone else had made a joke or said something which stirred his sense of humor. His joy was such that it was ready to bubble forth at a moment's notice. Although the visions previously mentioned had seemed like the veriest reality, and some of them had already manifested in the outer sense, still I had a great difficulty in accepting the things which God had revealed to me about myself and my own destiny. I thought surely that I must be suffering from hallucination, and my soul underwent great torture as a result. Suddenly I felt a compulsion to lay the whole matter before Papa, that I might have the relief of knowing the truth, whatever it might be. When I described the vision to Papa and asked him to help me either accept or reject it, he turned and, looking directly at me, said, "Mother, every word that God has told you was true." Then he said, there are three ways in which visions may be verified as truth. First, they are confirmed by a saint. Second, that they are verified in scriptures. And third, that they actually manifest and become prophecy fulfilled. A voice was heard over the loudspeaker system announcing that the plane was now ready for boarding. My son-in-law had been talking to Swami Satchidananda, whom he dearly loves, while Papa and I were together, and his face was filled with joy as he came to pay his respects to Papa and to say with joy and to say goodbye to him. As Papa gave us his final blessings, the bliss within him communicated itself to all of us, and we were as if intoxicated with the nectar of God's presence. He turned again and again to pranam to us while walking the distance between the airport and the plane. As the door closed on his beloved form, we all stood there searching the windows with a hope that we would have one more glimpse of him. Suddenly we saw him silhouetted against one of the windows with his hands again raised in pranam to us. As the plane flew into the heavens carrying its precious cargo, my soul soared on the wings of prayer to kneel before the Lord and give thanks for the great blessings he had bestowed upon us. An anti-climax, which was in itself a climax, cannot be left untold. Unwittingly, both Mr. Gregor and Ron had parked their cars directly opposite one another in the parking lot, but back to back. We were all still filled with bliss and scarcely aware of anything or anyone around us. We had said our goodbyes to the Gregors, and each of us had walked to our respective cars without noticing their close proximity. We all got in, and Mr. Gregor and Ron started their cars simultaneously, backed them up, and locked their rear wheels together. There was no crash because they were going slowly, but a gentle interlocking of the wheels. They got out, looked at each other sheepishly, saw that there was no damage to either car, apologized to each other, and drove away. As we drove down the Pacific Highway, Ryan kept running off the road. His mind was so concentrated on God and on Papa and his being so filled with bliss that it seemed impossible for him to follow a straight line. As can be imagined, it was rather a dangerous situation in which to find oneself, but he was completely helpless in it. However, God never fails his devotees. All of a sudden, there is a loud honking of horns and a roar of many motors from behind. I looked around, and there were six motorcycle policemen all riding along behind us. They followed us all the way into the city. The Lord had provided us with an escort to see us safely home. We were literally speechless. I could only say from the depths of my heart, Papa, Papa, how truly great is your power in God, and how all-encompassing your love and protection. Such an absolutely beautiful letter and description of Mother's meeting with Papa. As she said, that she had the opportunity to know two great Godmen in her life, and what an opportunity that was. It is said that even just the touch of a Godman, and that's man in generic, for that can be male or female, but just one touch, one thought, one look can be enough to transform the soul. And so in our own search, in our own desire to know God, let us come together and share the power and the presence of God within us. Let us dedicate ourselves to that purpose of knowing God until we are so filled with that presence that we can only think to ourselves, God, God, everywhere God. And by the sound of the firecrackers, I think that we've reached our portal into the new year. So Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year, David.
May God and the Master's blessings be upon you. May his love fill your hearts. His wisdom guide you. And his bliss ever lift you upon the wings of spirit. Let us treasure our time together. As a miser would collect his coins, let us collect our moments together and draw from it power and the presence and the feeling of God. Through inner prompting, let me just say that God had given me a tune to sing the Sri Ram from, and there's two different versions of it, but the one is very much a joyous, victorious type tune, and that's how it strikes me anyway. So I'm getting this inner prompting to sing it and teach it to you all, and for us to sing it together. So I'll sing it through once, and then if you'd like to join me, to join in the feeling of joy and victorious, that God is victorious in our life. Victory to God, victory to God. So I'll sing it through once. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. 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 Like to join me in that, and just what do they write on the little musical scores to sing it joyously, or they write little notes like that, so it's the feeling that goes with it. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. 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 Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram.